Hello and welcome to Wise Women, The Vicar and the Witch. I'm Maggie Whitehouse and I'm the Vicar.
And I'm Susie Crockford and I'm the Witch. We are perceived, perhaps, as being on opposite ends of a spectrum, but we're friends and we see the common threads of our different experience of the sacred. So please join us as we discuss
life, the universe and everything. Well, welcome. We are now in lockdown. We are recording this on Monday before broadcast, and Susie is outside her house, so you'll be hearing some birdsong and some wind. I would like to be sitting outside my house, but the wind is too high for that, so at least one of us is in nature, which is wonderful. Can you describe the view, Susie?
I'm sitting quite far outside of my house, actually. In order to get a decent signal to do this, I have had to go to the top of the field that is behind my house. And I'm sitting in a kind of fairy paradise, a little dingly dell of hawthorns full of bluebell leaves. But because we're 1,000 feet up here, there's no actual bluebells yet. But there's blackthorn, bosom and gorse, and a beautiful green field is kind of what I can see past the beautiful moss-covered trunk of an ancient hawthorn. It's pretty nice.
It's gorgeous.
But yes, apologies for the wind.
We both live in paradise. My heart goes out to people in cities at the moment, especially with people being a bit antsy about going to parks and things to walk. Whereas we can just walk out of our houses into quiet lanes onto Dartmoor. We are blessed beyond measure. But then,
absolutely.
Well, we can only hope that our podcast can cheer a few people up or maybe depress them even more. Who knows? Let's go for it.
My experience of the daily dose of Dartmoor, which I'm actually having a little teeny break from just at the moment, just because I went to the river and the river said rest. But the daily dose of, and that's definitely included, the daily dose of Dartmoor. But the messages I'm getting from people with that is, oh my goodness, sight of the wild, even on a screen through a photo, is nourishing to my soul. So, you know, we're a human animal. We need this desperately.
Well, I'm putting out similar pictures on Facebook as well with the daily appreciations, which is one of those things that occasionally I lose a friend from it.
It's
all right for you because you're living in paradise. And my point is always with putting appreciations is, one, they're not gratitudes, because if they're gratitudes, you've got to be grateful to somebody or something. And I think it's a better and easier way to start appreciating life to put appreciation rather than gratitude. It pushes fewer buttons. But also, if you appreciate what you have got, it's much easier to attract what you do want. And everybody can appreciate a cup of tea or a view from a window. And I think it's really important, especially in difficult times like these, that we can turn our minds to what is good, because the universe just does have this law of attraction. They called it the secret a few years ago and said, you know, it's the thing the Bible never told you about. It's all the way through the Bible, if you know how to read it. This is not some new age fad. This is the fact that we are creative children of a creative force, and what we say or do because of our consciousness creates.
Tell me more. I had absolutely no idea that was present anywhere in the Bible.
Oh, yes, it's hidden in plain view. You have to know what to look for, but that's the whole secret of all these religious texts, is that they need to be read on several different levels. You can't just read them literally, because they're nasty and brutish and misogynistic and vile if you read them as a history story, but then most history is. But if you actually, I mean, I don't read Hebrew, but I've got a dear friend who does, thank God, but he doesn't read New Testament Greek and I do, so we talk a lot about these things. But for a start, let's go right back pretty much to the beginning, to Genesis. Abraham, who was originally called Abram. Abram and Sarai became Abraham and Sarah. And they were told by the divine to leave their area. They lived in Ur of the Chaldees. And the divine said quite clearly, leave your family. And Abraham took his cousin Lot, who was nothing but trouble from then on. So you can see from the very beginning that humanity doesn't listen to the voice that we get through. And I'm guilty of that one too. But the line I wanted to mention was there's a bit where the Lord, this is Yahweh, this is the breath aspect of the divine. It's been taught to us a lot of as the harsh aspect of the divine. And it certainly is the more harsh aspect. But Yahweh is the breathing breath of the divine. So it's kind of a verb. And one of my teachers says that you can't live or die without speaking that name of the divine, because it's a breath. It's anyway, this Yahweh says to Abraham, look around you and I will give you all the land that you can see, to you and your seed forever. And of course, if you read that literally, it's that land belongs to you. And the whole of the Jewish Arab Israeli conflict is about the physical land. And they forget two things, one of which is Abraham had two sons, Ishmael and Isaac. The Ishmael fathered the Arabic nation, Isaac the Israeli nation. So they're meant to share the land as brothers, which hasn't been noticed lately. And the other thing was that this is a metaphor. The word see is actually the word perceive. I will give you everything physical that you can first imagine or perceive.
Right.
And doesn't that just change it dramatically?
Indeed, it does.
Whatever you're focusing on. And Jesus says the same, ask believing and it is given. And that one, if you go right into it, says that we are asking all the time. Every single word or thought a human being has is a prayer. So everything we're thinking about is a request. And everything that we're putting our attention on is going out into the universe as, this is what I'm focusing on. This is what I'm perceiving. Therefore, this is what the divine will give me. And it's a very difficult teaching for a lot of people, especially with challenging lives. And, you know, I'm somebody who obviously asked for many, many years for cancer, because that's what I got. It was amazing. It was horrible and vile. And I didn't ask for it consciously. I didn't ask for it out loud. I didn't ask for it in any way that I knew I was doing. I just knew that, one, I had a pathological fear of cancer. And there's another bit in the book of Job where Job, who had everything goes wrong for him, and he says, the thing I feared the most has come upon me. And that's another of the metaphysical teachings. But Job's one of the wisdom books. But I had so much anger and fear and hatred and stuff from childhood and built upon later and later about protection, that I had this huge thing going out from my psyche. I am not protected. I am not protected. Nobody will protect me. And as soon as I had that, of course, it started becoming truer, because the way the human mind is wired is that it needs to prove, the ego needs to prove that it's right.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it goes on from that, really. Does that make sense?
In shamanism, you know, kind of contemporary shamanism, the expression is energy goes where attention flows, or energy flows where attention goes. And that, you know, yeah, totally. We are co-creating our reality constantly by what we're paying attention to. And I once read, I don't remember who the writer being referred to was, but there's evidently a personage of note out there who made the statement that anyone ever who gets cancer has at some level of their being a death wish, and that death wish is not a kind of self-destructive, self-hating, you know, overt death wish. More usually, it is a kind of extreme version of, oh my goodness, I just need a rest, combined with a feeling that we cannot give ourselves permission to rest, because what we're doing is, for whatever reason, too important, either because we're, you know, in service to humanity, or, you know, heaven help us, in service to earning dollar, because that's the, you know, what's been dished out to us. But you've had cancer, I've had cancer, I know for me that was definitely true. I was desperate for a rest. And so, you know, now when the river says rest to me in very capital letters, I turn everything off and I go and rest because I don't want to be there again.
Absolutely. Well, I take a Sabbath every week, a day off. And that's one of the, I was doing it before I was ill, but it wasn't enough. It was, for me, it was actually about realizing that God always protects me, the divine protects me, and that my pattern of being unprotected by human beings was an inside out pattern, and I needed to allow what was going to happen in the full knowledge that I was protected, whether I died or not. This was all okay. And it took a long time to get there. It took me 3 years of disease to get there. And another thing I had to learn, which was really difficult, my first husband died from chemotherapy, and the registrar at the hospital told me that. It's not me making it up. He had a year to live with terminal melanoma, but he was dead in 2 weeks after taking chemotherapy because it destroyed his stomach. And in fact, he threw up his stomach over me while I was holding him while he died. So it was fairly clear that it wasn't the cancer that actually killed him. So I had, when you have a trauma like this, it goes in and it goes in very deep. And that follows on from childhood, not liking my childhood doctor. And I got pretty soon the idea that medicine was dangerous and chemotherapy in particular. So I became one of those people who was totally anti-chemotherapy. And if you give your life to the divine, you can't have these views. You know, you've got to be much more wide open to sometimes this is good, sometimes this is not so good. Every human being is different, every case is different. And if you're going to spend your life pushing against Big Pharma, guess what's going to happen? You're going to need Big Pharma one day.
Indeed. And
one of my lessons with the cancer was to understand that even though I was not so much right, but I was correct in my view that it was an internal job to get through this, I had to have chemo to buy me time. Otherwise, I would have died. And so I had to give up. I had to have metanoia. I had to think anew. I had to not ever be able for the rest of my life to go, chemotherapy is wrong, end of. Yeah. Because although it killed my husband, it saved me. And you know, the ultimate irony was when I was sitting there in the consultant's office going, oh, God, I don't know. I don't know. This is a really big issue. I know I haven't got much time, etc. But. The consultant said to me, well, we could put you on a trial of a new drug that we're using for this. And she named the exact drug that had killed my husband.
Whoa.
And that was the point at which something just came straight through and said, are you listening, honey? Are you listening?
Yeah.
Are you listening here? I didn't have that drug. I had a different drug, and it did buy me the time I needed to take the next 2 years to do all the work that cleared it for me. And hopefully that's it for good. But one never knows. One never knows anyone when one's going to die. There are fewer buses, but we still could get run over by a bus. And I've never understood that thing about you have to wear clean underwear in case you're run over by a bus, because if you're run over by a bus, you will not have clean underwear at the end of it.
Indeed, I know.
But can we get back to this idea of the Sabbath? Because one of the things that Jesus said was the Sabbath was made for humanity. Humanity was not made for the Sabbath, because Jesus always interpreted the ancient laws through love. And he was a scandalous man, you know. He deliberately went out to pick stuff on the Sabbath to test the Pharisees. He was always scandalous. And actually, he's described as scandalizo in the New Testament quite a lot, that the authorities were always scandalized by him. But it's nowadays fairly scandalous to say to anybody, you should take a day off a week. I know it was imposed in the old days by the church, and I used to find Sundays really boring as a child. But if you won't rest, Kabbalistically, the tree of life, which is in the Bible at the very beginning, Genesis, and at the end, and mentioned in the wisdom teachings as well, is all about balance. And if you won't rest, the last 20, 30 years, we've just done do, more. And there's been not even one day a week where we just don't do what we do every other day. We don't even rest buildings.
Yeah.
And there is such a thing as building syndrome. And it comes back to, if the doing is more important than the being, how can spirit get through to us?
Well, absolutely. And you know, we're not a human doing. We are a human being. And and intriguingly, in fact, before certainly in these lands, before there was such a thing as Sunday, there was Thursday. And to the pagan peoples of the British Isles, certainly post the Viking invasions, a good woman rested on a Thursday. And, you know, even the weavers and the spinners put down their spindles and their looms in order to rest. And that resting was most definitely associated with listening.
How interesting. Why Thursday? Because with the modern Marvel Comics movies and all that, we don't think of Thor as being a restful god at all.
I don't actually know at all, and I haven't read anything on it because Thor's not
your line of expertise.
Not my line of expertise, no. Although I do have a very dear friend whose line of expertise it is, so I shall certainly ask. But my sense is that simply that Thursday, you know, Thursday may well have taken over from a previous British god or goddess when the Vikings arrived, and just, you know, it's the point in the week when people rested. But there's particular kind of Christian decrees from something like the year 500 or something, saying that, you know, specifically banning women weavers and spinners in particular, because they were clearly the most rebellious, from resting on a Thursday and insisting that they rest instead on a Sunday.
That's extraordinary. You were also talking the other day about there was a Catholic ruling, not necessarily a doctrine, but a ruling that women should distance themselves from their children, and that was about 100 years ago. It's quite extraordinary what authoritarian rubbish there is out there.
It ain't over yet.
Oh no, it ain't over yet. But actually, let me digress for a minute, because we did talk a few weeks ago about the House of Israel and the children of Israel, and you made a very valid point about the House of Israel suppressing the children of Israel. And I hadn't thought of that before, so I said, yes, yeah, I can see that. But actually, going into it in a bit more detail, I wasn't correct about that, because the automatic assumption is, and it's an utterly understandable one, is that the House of Israel is the authority, it's the king, it's the priest, it's the this. But it's intended to be the mystic. So the one person who would never suppress another would be a member of the House of Israel. It's the children of Israel who operate at the vegetable and animal levels in the mystical tradition who would be the suppressors. It would be particularly the animal people, the ones who are out for control or power, the ones who wanted to round up the other people and herd them and make them behave in certain patterns. So the House of Israel is actually anybody who is far more into the non-dual consciousness and would not seek to impose any rule on the other. It's actually the children of Israel are the ones who haven't learnt that yet. They're not working from the level of the soul. But I can actually understand why one would automatically associate House of Israel as being thinking it was superior, whereas actually it's the ones who are struggling with the relationship with the divine, the ones who are saying, I'm showing up, I don't understand, I don't know, rather than the ones who say, it's like this and you've got to do that.
So some of the children of Israel are oppressing some of the other children of Israel.
Yeah.
What do you mean by the animal, more animal ones?
Ah, in Kabbalistic teaching, which is the Jewish mystical tradition, we are said to work at four levels. Mineral, which is the basic, utterly basic, get up, eat, reproduce, go to bed. Then there's vegetable, which is, majority of us work at the vegetable level most of the time. It's the level of the ego. And there's nothing wrong with it whatsoever. It's just that we're meant to sort of grow through it. And that would be the vegetable children of Israel. And vegetables basically are born, grow, seek the sunlight, have sex, reproduce, grow old and die. And the first time humans come down on this planet, the first incarnations, that's what we do, because we're learning how to survive. and we're learning how to work in harmony with the land. So positive vegetable is working in harmony with the seasons, working in harmony with the moon, working in harmony with hydroponics, working in harmony with how the land is and being part of that weaving pattern. So healthy vegetable is excellent. And unhealthy vegetable is basically sitting on the sofa all the time, just ordering a takeout because you can't be bothered to move. You can't move very far in that level of consciousness anyway, because you wouldn't be flying around the world. But that's the unhealthy form of vegetating. And the animal level is the level we have to go through to get to the soul. And the positive animal level is a healthy individuation coming out of a positive childhood, which not that many of us have, where you become the individual you. And the story in the Bible is the Exodus story of Moses going out into the desert or Jesus going into the wilderness. It's the time when you have to break away from the tribe. But you use all the good teachings the tribe has given you on survival, which of course we don't have in the modern world, and go out in the desert to find who you really are. It's Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, if you like. So the positive animal experience is going to find who you are and surviving on the land alone to strengthen your courage. So you become a courageous person. And then once you've done that, you will get into the level of the soul, which you'll have the great experience that you need to take back to the tribe. But the negative animal, of course, is the one that rounds up the others and is cruel to them. I mean, the Pharaoh in the Egypt story has got the Hebrews in slavery, and that's the negative animal, which is the one that needs to have the control that will say, these are the laws, you are in trouble if you break them, and I'm going to accrue all the riches, and you're going to live in slavery to me. So there's always the positive or the negative. But the difficulty with all the negative animal that we see in the world at the moment, most of the governments, New Zealand and most of the female-led governments are an extraordinary exception. And if you even read what Angela Merkel wrote on Twitter about the reason why she was following the lockdown rules, it was clearly put in beautiful words. And I have to say the feminine leadership in the world is doing extraordinarily well, but mostly the masculine. Let's come, in this case it is men and women, though we were very clear last week the masculine and feminine toxicity has got nothing to do with the gender of the actual human being. But the you will do this, and in President Trump's case it appears to be you will do, you know, do what I say, do not do what I do. It's a very negative animal. So there's an awful lot in the world of the you shall do this because I say so and because it makes me richer. But that makes it very hard for the spiritual seeker to go out into this animal world because they see it only as negative, but it's not. You have to become self-sufficient within yourself and be able to leave your tribe. And what so many spiritual people do, Christians included, Muslims included, Buddhists included, all religions included, and Reiki teachers included, and all holistic people included, is quite often you leave your tribe, you go out for a while, you get terribly excited about becoming a life coach or a healer or this, and you simply join another tribe. And you can tell if you join the other tribe because you're going to make the other people in a similar tribe wrong. And you can see this so much in Christianity. There was a wonderful joke on the website Ship of Fools, which is a fabulous site for taking the piss out of Christianity. Oh, here's the obligatory swear word. And there was a joke that won their joke of the year competition was about a man who sees another man who's about to jump off a bridge. So he goes up to him and says, no, no, don't do it. I'm sure there's something that we can do that will help your life. I mean, have you got a belief? And the man who's about to jump goes, yes, I'm a Christian. And the first man goes, oh, marvelous. So am I. What kind of Christian? He goes, oh, I'm a Baptist. And one says, oh, well, yes, that's wonderful. So am I. I'm sure we can talk. Let's keep talking. What kind of Baptist? Are you a pre-1847? This is just me making it up at the moment. 1847 Reformist Baptist or post-Reformist Baptist? And the other one goes, I'm post-Reformist Baptist. And the first one goes, oh, wonderful. Do you follow this line or that line? And the first man goes, I follow this line. And the first man goes, die, heathen scum, and walks away. because that's how we get. We get so ridiculously, my tribe is right, your tribe is wrong. And the pathway to the soul is to walk through that into the desert and say, nothing is right or wrong. But we're walking together. As the great teacher Ram Dass said, we're in the end, we're all walking each other home.
Yeah. Oh, goodness, I love that. I love that phrase. We're all walking each other home. It's so beautiful. Yeah. So I'm intrigued by these categories. And are these seen as being a kind of horizontal thing or a vertical thing, if you see what I mean? Are they like the pie chart of the whole being, or are they seen as phases that we somehow evolve through or live through or something with being soulfully connected at the top?
They're sort of like a spiral, if you like to think about a sort of going up in a spiral cone, because in life we often find, and I know I do, and most of my friends do, you think you've dealt with a problem, but then you get to another layer of the onion. And I think
right.
What happens is that in ancient days we had vegetable experiences in what we would call indigenous tribes now. So we learned how to live with the land, and we learned how to do all the important thing of relating to the land, and we had our very distinct place in that tribe and our use in the tribe. Whereas nowadays we've got people incarnating for the very first time into cities. You have to try and learn how to live at the vegetable level in a city without any connection to the land, and that's incredibly hard. So the souls who are coming in for the first time now are souls that have really chosen a tough line, and maybe this virus is one of the ways to help these people to connect more with nature, to get more in tune with it. Because unfortunately, if you come down and you don't have any connection, healthy connection at the vegetable level, you're going to get into the difficult cycle of being the couch potato. And the difficulty of the negative vegetable is it blames. And the first teaching in the Bible is about not blaming. That's this whole thing about the tree of knowledge. As soon as you've got the knowledge of good or evil, you can stand up and say, I'm right, you're wrong, I'm good, you're bad, and then the blame game begins. So it kind of cycles, and as in different lives, I think you come down to live vegetable, animal, and hopefully in the end human lives in different circumstances and at different times. So an advanced soul might very well come down to live a life as a severely disabled person, which is a very vegetable level life because you can't move, but it would be a huge teaching for the soul. So it's never black and white set in stone. It's always, there is a reason for this. How can we bring the spirit through in the best circumstances?
So in my language, this is a series of expanding and contracting gyres, which can most simply be explained, as with all things, in a kind of a series of lemniscates, which perhaps, if you gather them all into the same place, makes something somewhat like the flower of life.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful parallel analogy. And what we're taught is that every human soul, and possibly our souls on other planets, we don't know about that, every human soul will experience absolutely everything in their lives. We will all commit murder, we will all be murdered, we will all be rapists, we will all be raped, we will all be farmers, we will all be soldiers, but we will have a tendency towards a particular incarnation, because each soul is one spark in the body of the divine baby that's to be born at the end of end of creation, and goodness knows what's going to happen then. So some of us are more prone to incarnations as healers, or more prone to incarnations as soldiers or as teachers, but even so, we've still got to get the whole spectrum, because ultimately each one of us will perfect, and we will each be one cell in the divine baby, and something glorious beyond all imagination should happen then.
So this is the first I've heard of a divine baby that's happening at the end of humanity.
Well,
please explain.
Not this time. Should we start
no.
with this
time? You're cruel.
I am, but I think we've been talking for half an hour, so I think I'm going to leave that till next time.
Okay. I await with bated breath.